Sled Dog Podcast, Episode 5, Interview with John Little.
Welcome to the Sled Dog Podcast. This is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that astonishes, astounds, and assists you on the sport of dog sledding.
Three A's today?
That's right.
Good. Well, awesome. We have a wonderful interview today with John Little, writer for Cabela's, who covers the Iditarod every year. He has a very unique way of writing and also just the ability to write articles quick and to the point, but yet graphic and illustrative enough so that all of us being able to watch and read from a distance can really enjoy the Iditarod. And, you know, Gene, I tell you, every year about Iditarod time comes, the end of February, beginning of March, we get pretty excited about the Iditarod. You're always laughing at me because I'm glued to the computer.
Right.
Trying to figure out, who's in first, what's happening, what's happening on the race course. And it's just amazing how many articles that John is able to put out. I think he mentioned that at one time or many times during the race that he's actually producing 3 to 4 articles a day to get them out to us. And you can tell by his not only the content of the information that's flowing out of the area, but also just the quality and the scope of what he's writing is wonderful.
Absolutely. And even though he's also a freelance writer, if you were to go onto the Iditarod website and take a look at the things that you're reading, most of the articles on there are by him.
So the interview is kind of a long interview. It's about 40 minutes long. It's fantastic stuff. And he really hones in on a topic that we ask him to talk about, something that he's very passionate about, and that is being able to keep a kennel smaller while still being able to win races. He still, as you'll hear, runs quite a few races throughout the season and does a fantastic job with them.
Yes, the topic of keeping a kennel at a reasonable size in order to competitively race is a tough one, and everybody has their own opinions on it, but we enjoyed hearing John's. We struggle with the same thing, being a small, non-type competitive family mushing kennel. There are 5 of us that race in our family, and we have about 20 dogs, and some people in northern Michigan just think we're crazy. But in reality, it takes 16 to 19 dogs for us just to race on a given day because there's 5 of us racing. So we're actually short. So everybody has a different stance out there. We're trying to stay small as well just because it keeps costs down and it takes time. And we are not that competitive. We do really family-style racing where there is no money involved and what have you. So we also like to do a lot of times on the weekend. We have friends and family come, and we run the trails with them. And so, but it is interesting. It is a topic of good discussion, especially if you're going to get into this sport. It's very easy to acquire dogs quickly.
Yes. And, and he brings up some really good points about, thinking about what's not only just best for the mushers and what's best for the racers, but really what's best for the dog. And his strategy or his theory on how to manage that kennel and what to look for in the dogs, but also when it's time to move a dog on. I think you'll be surprised when you hear some of the things he talks about what time and what age the dogs that he'll move on instead of maybe waiting longer. So it's an interesting interview from lots of different perspectives, and also you'll hear the journalism side, and he tells us about how he got into journalism and also why he got into it, and more importantly, why he stayed in it so long. So let's get to the interview, and don't forget, go to the website, www.sleddogpodcast.com, and leave us some comments on any of the different podcasts that you listen to, or drop us an email. You can go to the contact page and let us know.
Tell us about it, and if you'd like to hear about a particular topic, by all means, please send us an email and say, hey, I'd like to know about that or this.
So let's get to the podcast. Thank you, John, for joining us today. And John, I think before we get started too far, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started in mushing and what you're doing now?
Well, believe it or not, all I really wanted was a cat. and that's the truth. I was looking for a cat because my apartment complex that I lived in at the time wouldn't allow large dogs. But I went to the pound and a dog did a belly crawl up to me. I thought, well, I'll take a dog. And it really snowballed from there. I won't go into any excruciating detail, but I started ski drawing. Then Tim Osmar, I hung around Tim Osmar, who a lot of people know pretty well.
Yeah.
He's been running the Iditarod since 85. he gave me four dogs that really weren't making the grade on his team, and an old beat-up sled and a bent snow hook. And I kind of goofed around for a couple years, entered local races, wondered why I was coming in near the back of the pack, and sort of launched into a program where I would, you know, try to buy and breed, buy first, breed later, better dogs, give away and sell the ones that weren't working out for me. And basically, I followed that format since about 1994, and that's where I've gotten today. And I've run a lot of mid-distance races in Alaska. I really enjoy mid-distance. To me, mid-distance is 200 to 300 miles. And I especially love 1,000-mile races, long distance. But, you can't always run those as often as you'd like. Right. I've done fairly well in that. I'm a distance musher by nature. I know there's sprint and stage and recreational and guys who go out with Malamutes and pull logs around, and there's every kind of dog mushing out there. But for some reason, in my core, I just gravitated towards distance mushing, and that's where I find the satisfaction.
Fantastic. And is there any particular races that you like to race more than others?
Lately, the Kuskokwim 300 is just a friend of mine. I just love that race. I'm just happy to be in it every year. I've done it like 4 years in a row, I think. I do well in it, and I like it there. It just suits me really well. In the past, Copper Basin 300 has been a really fun race for me. Iditarod, I've always loved the Iditarod every time. Every time I run it, I've run that 5 times. I had a lot of fun. I have fun in every race I run. If it's 150 miles or whatever, even a local race of 250-mile heats back-to-back, I always have a good time. I always feel kind of at peace once the race starts. And same with even a local sprint race I run.
Well, that's awesome. Now, you started in 1994. Well, you started before that, but in 94 you started kicked it off?
I think I entered my first race. It was either the winter of 93 or 94. I'm not even sure.
I guess, was it a passion to race, or was it more of I think I'll jump into these races just for the fun of it, or?
Yeah, I kind of backed into it. I never in my mind I considered doing a 1,000-mile race, and I just thought the local race here is the Tustamina 200, and that's a fun one, and that's the one I started running. Yeah, and I just thought, well, let's see if I can get the team in shape enough to complete it and see what I think of it. And then once you've done something like that once, as you probably well know, you realize all the things you could do better, and you got to wait a year to try them out again. And that's sort of how this thing gets addictive, and that's why you see people running these races year after year after year.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Now, have you always lived in Alaska, or when did you come?
No, I was born in England. Not that I would remember it, because I got flown over here when I was 2 years old, over to Seattle, where my dad got a job with Boeing in the late 60s, because Boeing thought it was going to make a supersonic transport and all sorts of things, and it didn't happen. But we stayed there, and I grew up in Seattle, and then I came up here in 1987.
Oh, wow.
It's been 20 years.
Looking for adventure, or...
Yeah, I was right out of college, and there was a little newspaper that wanted a reporter, and I thought, well, that sounds like a really good time. And I was going to spend 2 years up in Alaska, then move on.
a stepping stone, per se?
Yeah, and my career path, it never went vertical. It just kind of went horizontal.
Was it because of the location or because of the career? Or?
I think it's just my mindset. I just go with where I feel like I'm led, and this is where it's gone.
Yeah, and with that, I guess, tell us a little bit about, the careers that you've had over this time that have kind of helped or at least allowed you to stay in the sport.
Well, I started out as trying to figure out how to be a reporter at a small newspaper here on the Kenai Peninsula, and that's really been how I've made my money ever since, one way or another. I ended up working for the Anchorage Daily News in 1995, and stayed there through 2003. Mm-hmm. And then about that time, I'd come off of a fourth-place finish in the Iditarod, and it was getting increasingly hard to train up a dog team to race the Iditarod and hold down a regular job 5 days a week. And Cabela's called me and said, hey, are you interested in helping cover the race?
What'd you say?
I actually gave it a couple of months to think it over. And eventually said yes, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
Oh, that is fantastic. Now, will they allow you to run it too, or?
No, that's the hitch, is yeah. I can't run the Iditarod as long as I cover it for Cabela's, but then I can't race all winter with an 8-to-5 job that I'm aware of right now.
Right.
And so it's a compromise I'm definitely willing to accept.
Oh, that's absolutely. And do you write for, because you're freelance, do you also write for other papers and so forth throughout the year?
Yeah, I've done a couple articles for Alaska Magazine and a little bit for Mushing Magazine, not nearly enough. I haven't been aggressive with that. Just here and there, bits and pieces, mostly to do with mushing.
I guess when you were growing up, what caused you to get into reporting?
You know, it wasn't anything too deep, unfortunately. I was good with words. I was always good at spelling in elementary school. It came easy to me. And so I just sort of gravitated towards it. And I went to college at Northwestern University to get a journalism degree, somehow got it. And
that's great.
So before we move on to what we came here to talk about, so is there a book in the future?
There should be. it's been talked about. There's been a couple of photographers that are at least trying to put together books that I might help out with just a little bit of text. And as far as my own novel or something, I'd sure like to do it. I'm just sort of waiting for the right sort of topic or the right sort of issue to thread it all together. Something that hasn't been said yet.
And that's good.
And I haven't got it yet.
Yeah.
Any second. That's good.
I understand. I do some writing myself, so. Well, let's talk a little bit about one of your passions, and that is kennel management and keeping a kennel to a reasonable size of dogs, meaning number.
Yeah.
How do you do it? I mean, you know, we've got, I guess there's four racers or five racers here in the family. We've got over 20 dogs, and, you know, for us, we can just see it getting really out of control. How do you do it, or how have you kept a balance?
Well, first of all, it's not like this is the... I wouldn't tell anybody this is the way to do it. I think you can have 50 dogs. I think you can have 100 dogs. I think you can have 12 dogs. It's really, you know, what... It's a very personal decision. I think it's a real art, and everyone has a different way of approaching it, and they should. I think if you just try to copy somebody else, you're getting into trouble in the long run. I think if you're new and just starting out, copying is the way to go. You've got to learn what it is you're doing before you can break from the mold. But that said, I really just can't imagine myself having 50 dogs. And I've got 33 technically now, although I think six of them are retired and six of them are puppies. Anyway, I know I've got 17 raceable adults right now, and that's including some yearlings. And that's a little low, but there's reasons for that. We're having our second baby here in October or November.
And oh, congratulations.
So I'm keeping things a little quiet this year. But I generally keep it at 24, and I found that if I get a handler on board for the winter, and I have, you know, sort of the 12 dogs that are my core A-team dogs, and 12 made up of good leaders and yearlings and that sort of thing for the handler, that we can go run 12 dogs each at the same time we take off. The handler does everything I do. You know, we're like, we're totally in sync that way. And I can get all the dogs run at once, take a day off, you know, go do it the next day, and we can really gauge the dogs that way, and I can bring them all along together. And I've found that I can work with a small number and do pretty well. And it means that I'll accept dogs that some people might not. I don't mind pacers. If they're not pulling all the time, I really don't sweat it. It depends. You got to read each dog, and I think that's where the experience comes in. You learn what's important and what to worry about and what to be annoyed with and what to let go. You know, I don't mind dogs that are 75 pounds necessarily, and some people freak out if they're over 65.
How did you learn everything that you've learned? Is it something that you just paid attention, or have you learned from other folks, or both?
A lot of trial and error. Definitely, I read every book in the local libraries when I was starting out. I read Mushing Magazine voraciously. And I just tried to pick up everything I could. Entering races is the best way to learn. You can't learn half as much as you can in any other way. You know, physically racing a dog and getting to the dog team and getting to the finish line teaches you so much more than anything else. Just being around other mushers who are working at checkpoints and just going through it and seeing your own dogs and seeing them work through several hundred miles, there's nothing comparable to that. And so just a lot of racing, I think, is the best way. And a lot of errors and being open-minded and realizing that maybe what you did wasn't very smart.
Yeah. I think we've all been there. That's a good one. When it comes to racing, I guess, and you think about some of the people that are just now starting getting into either sprints or mid-distance or even to the larger races, what do you think would be some great strategies for them to kind of put in the back of their mind? Obviously, reading everything you can, observing. There's a lot of schools and different things. Do you recommend anything, or have you heard of anything that would be good for the learners?
Well, I've never heard of a distance dog mushing school. I think that's a great idea. There's none up in Alaska that I'm aware of. That's usually what I get my handlers for. I always tell my handlers, I'll teach you everything I know. You know, I don't pay. I just give you room and board, but I'll put you in races and I'll teach you everything I can. And so sort of being a handler is a great way to do it if you're willing to be an apprentice for a whole winter with the right kennel.
Right.
I would advise people not to jump in too fast with too many dogs in a breeding program before you know what you're looking at. You're going to have to suck it up and probably buy some dogs from other mushers. I think that's the smartest way to go. And race. And get them in shape to race. Learn how to get a dog team ready to race. And we can talk about that. But, you know, and then enter a race and really get a feel for it. And you know, look at the dogs that are doing really well at the finish line. Take notes after the race, I mean, within hours of the race. And everything you did and everything you could have done better, because you're going to forget it otherwise.
So how much time, let's say you've been racing and you've got a dog that obviously is appearing pretty mediocre in the spirit of what we're talking about of keeping a kennel tight and smaller, how long does it take for you to say, okay, this is time to find Rover a new home?
Usually when they're age 4 to 5, and I'll sell good dogs at age 4 to 5. I do it all the time. I've got one that made it to Koyuk last year on the third place team, and she's for sale. It's just that what I do is I look at my young dogs coming up, if they're 2 years old and they can step in, and even if I'm not sure, even if I think maybe they could, I'll say, well, I'm going to sell this 4 and 5 year old and let that 2 year old and give it a try. So I kind of look at it like an NFL team or even a college football team, where you've got young guys coming in, and sometimes the old ones you find new homes for, and that some people may not have a difficult time with that, but that's the way I do it. I just look around and I quote unquote sell the dog, and often it's for not very much money if I can find the right match, and I just wait long enough, and it just happens that I just have the right people either call me or something like that happens, and I find homes for them really easily. And it, of course, I have an advantage now that I have a name, I have a reputation, the dogs are doing well. So there are people who want my dogs. That helps. But even when I was starting out, that worked. I really didn't have any problems. And I didn't do anything rash. I didn't have like four to eight litters every summer or anything
right.
like that, where it was like panic mode, where you have 60 puppies and you don't know what to do. I've always had one or two litters, and I've been able to work with it.
What type of dogs do you use? Is there a particular, I don't want to say flavor, but you know, I mean, there's between the Eurohounds and everything. What is there anything particular that you look for in the dogs?
Yeah, that's one of the things that was just pure luck and being in the right place in the right time when I started out. There was a couple actually who lived in the house that I'm in now. It was Dave Shear, and his wife at the time was Dana. They have gotten divorced. And right around the time they got divorced, they were selling out dogs, and I bought a bunch of their dogs. And they'd done a lot of homework, and they went and bought some dogs from Bill Cotter and Gareth Wright. And, there were some other ones, and some local dogs mixed in, the local Kasilop area, sort of hard-nosed, old-school trotting Iditarod dogs. And they blended speed and toughness and came up with a really nice bloodline, and that's really the core of my kennel. And I've been working with that pretty much ever since. I've been splitting litters with Dean Hosmer, and I've gone to different kennels, you know, got some breedings and stuff like that.
That's wonderful.
They're just your Alaskan Huskies. You know, much what everyone else is racing. They're pretty fast and pretty tough.
As far as some of the basics go, what kind of dog food do you use and so forth? Is it?
Yeah, I've been with Eagle Pack since I started, and I figure if it's not broke, don't fix it. They their bowel movements are great when they're racing. They like it, they eat it, they stay fit on it. I do mix in a couple of other brands just to have, so I have more than one dog food as an option, and that's basically to spice it up a little bit. And I feed a lot of, I live in salmon country, so I get salmon for almost nothing or free.
Okay.
So they eat salmon almost every day in the winter especially, and I also get beef fat and stuff like that. I keep it really simple. I don't have a lot of supplements. I figure the folks at Eagle Pack and these other, and there's other high-octane dog food companies too, they know what they're doing, and I really don't supplement much. I'm not, I really do live by the keep it simple, stupid philosophy, and I've been able to do okay with it.
That's awesome.
Now, going back to the age of the dog, as you kind of said, a lot of times you'll see a 4 and 5-year-old that's a good dog, whether they're mediocre or good, and maybe it's time to move them on. So would you say that your smaller kennel is more of a younger kennel then?
A lot of the times I feel like I've got this perpetual puppy team where I don't know. Like a lot of times I'll go run Cusco and I'll think to myself, well, I don't know how I'm going to do because these 2-year-olds, you know, or 3-year-olds are really unproven. And it's like this. That's a drawback to the size of the kennel I have. I'm not going to have a huge core of veteran dogs. I'll have a core, maybe 8 to 10 dogs that are in prime age. But you get beyond that, and there's a lot of question marks. And that's part of the fun for me is seeing how those younger dogs step up. And the reason that 4 or 5 age comes up is I figured that's a saleable dog that has many years left in it that can really help somebody out.
Okay. Well,
that's a good idea.
And I have a lot of retirees too, but I always, you know, I'd have a ton if I didn't sell or give away, you know, 2 or 3 dogs every spring.
And what's the age of a retired dog for you?
Well, it depends on the dog. Those 75 pounders, I had a couple of them that I loved dearly, and they were great. They finished. I did ride a couple times, but at age 7, they started having a tough time keeping up, and so they retired early. But, you know, I've got some 8-year-olds that are still doing okay. I have a 10-year-old who's amazing, and he ran the Chattanooga 200 with my puppy team last year, finished it at age 9. And at 10, I'm just going to keep training him until he shows signs of not wanting to keep up. Teaching him carefully, because there's no point in driving him to the point where he gets unhappy. So I'm going to watch real carefully. This year, we'll probably, I doubt he'll race, but he'll probably train with the dog team, and then we'll watch him.
And so what do your 1-year-olds get to do?
I plug them in right away, and a lot of people don't do much with their 1-year-olds, or they run them in sprints or something, and that's it. I put them right in the program and train them aggressively initially, and I watch them very carefully. Again, I think that's where experience pays off, is I watch them for any sign whatsoever of them not being happy. And then I just, you know, if I'm running like 2 days in a row or 3 days in a row, and I see them on that first day look a little iffy, I'll just sit them out for the next 2, and they won't do, you know, those heavy repetitions. But I'll race them in the Sheep Mountain 150. Last year, my yearlings did the Sheep Mountain 150. They did the Tustamina 100. They did the Clam Gulch Classic, which was a double 35. And then they went up and did the Chattanooga 200, which I think is 220. And they did that in March, the same time as I did ride. So they, you know, and every once in a while, there's a few of them that get fat out of this race or that race, but, you know, I've had good luck with that. And then when they're 2-year-olds, I take them over to Cusco or something like that, and again, I watch them carefully because the Cusco is a race where they've got to be in peak shape, and I'll drop them the minute they show signs that they're not really into it.
And so looking at those puppies, throwing them in here, throwing them in there, and watching them closely, do you ever decide to sell a puppy, a 1-year-old, and what are those factors?
I have a couple times done that. I haven't sold puppies since a long time ago. I think I sold 2 of them to, I know I sold 2 of them to Judy Currier, and I think that was the last time I sold any puppies. They ended up doing great for her. 1-year-old occasionally, like if I'm trying to keep my numbers down, you know, if I'm at 25, 26 dogs, and I've done that with a couple of puppies.
And so what did you see in them?
Maybe one. I will get a little picky if there's a big dog, you know, and I have an option. You know, if he's 65 pounds or something, and the rest of them are 50, he'll kind of be on the list, but not necessarily. You know, anything.
Yeah.
Once I sold a dog because every time I wanted to go hook it up, it would put on the brakes and try to sit down. It wouldn't let me walk it over to the gang line, and I got annoyed by that, and I ended up selling it. And it just ran in lead for a musher in last year's I did a ride.
Oh, man.
Oh, no, it's no big deal.
Yeah. Okay.
I want to sell good dogs.
Yeah,
I want
good.
People to be happy.
Then that's good.
Yeah, there's been rare cases when people haven't been happy, but most of the time we match people up real well.
That is awesome. So how do you find the balance with the time and the effort that you're spending in not only in the kennel but with the training, and obviously having a hired or non-hired hand, somebody to help you run the kennel helps out in the wintertime, but is it, are you just like overwhelmingly busy during the wintertime, or how is that?
Wintertime can be extremely busy, especially if I'm at my peak with, you know, 24 racing dogs and probably yearlings on the way up and stuff like that. It's just busy like a job, but
right.
Not too busy. I try to get it all done during work hours. Like if we're going on a 50 or 60 mile run, we'll get going at 9 in the morning and try to be back around dinner time. And then, you know, at nighttime, there's not a lot extra to do.
No, that's great.
Occasionally I do, you know, overnight runs and stuff like that as well, but they're not the routine. They're the unusual thing.
Well, we're recording this in the early part of September. Have you started your training for the year already?
I almost don't want to tell you the truth.
Okay, don't then. what should we hear?
Oh yeah, I've been training. We're doing 50s.
Great, awesome.
That's what everyone wants to say by that. No, but what I've done the last 2 or 3 years is I back off. I used to start in like early August, like August 2nd or 3rd, and there'd be mosquitoes out, and I'd be struggling with heat, and the dogs would be doing short distances, and you know their tongues would be dragging on the ground, and. And the last 2 years, I just waited. I just sat on my hands, and it's really hard to do. Last year, I did start in late August because it got cool. And this year, I've been trying to get a moose and have not been successful. But I haven't started yet, but I'm really feeling the pull. I mean, it is like I'm really having to keep myself away from getting on the four-wheeler and training the dogs. But usually by now, but the year before last, I waited until mid-September to even do anything. And I just launched into five-milers. And I had a great year. So.
How do you normally work up? You go from like 5 miles, do you then make big jumps, or how do you get ready?
Go from 5 to maybe 7. We don't have a lot of fall training here. In fact, I start out on the roads. Literally, we have to run. I have to train them to run down the right side of the road, or else we'd have a head-on with a car. They're dirt roads, but, you know, we cross the highway. And the most I can do, I think, is about 14 on a four-wheeler and without getting really creative.
Right.
And so I'll get them up to about 14 miles by late October, and by which time I can usually find snow around here.
Then
I jump into the 20s very rapidly. And then from 20s, it's a very short amount of time before I'm doing a 40. I'll just go on a 20, camp for a couple hours, and do another 20. And then once I've done a 40, I'm doing 50s, and I just go very rapidly up into long distance.
Now, does your handler run at the same time with you, or do you just go out by yourself, per se?
No, same time. I want everybody to run at the same time. So they go with me, and we do the same thing. And that way I can teach them, because they're usually somebody with no experience whatsoever. And so I'm working with them, showing them what it is to take care of a dog and how to booty and all that stuff.
And so, obviously, if you were to have, like, a 50 to 70 dog kennel, either you're not running all your dogs, or you need more handlers, or you're going to be running dogs all day long. Is that basically it?
Well, that's the way it would be for me, is I would have to have probably 2 handlers at least. And, yeah, I'd be running every day for sure, and I would have no time to do other things. Or it seems that way to me, and that's why I've kept it down. That's why I've kept the numbers down.
Right.
Anything that you can give the listeners and say, you know, as you're getting started or running, what other advice would you give us to kind of get better at what we're doing and or to keep learning?
Definitely have a relationship with the dogs. I think some people see the dogs as they don't work with them so much as they may be a little too strict of a parent. If you're happy, I mean, one of Lance Mackey's strengths is, and I've seen him in a lot of races, is he is enthusiastic. I mean, he's cheering those dogs up and he's getting them happy, and he never. I mean, that is something that he's probably better at than most of the guys out there as far as just outward physical joy out there on the trail. And everyone expresses it differently, and not everyone has to be jumping up and down and clapping their hands. But I'd say that a lot of people are too reserved and not getting in there and looking at the dog's eyes and sort of getting the dogs to work for them.
Right.
Not sure if I'm saying that very well.
No, we are. I mean, obviously, just us going out and doing chores every day, you get to that point of sometimes you just drop the bowl instead of playing around and horsing around with the dog. And you're right, it is critical to do that.
Yeah. That's huge. Just because you have a day where maybe you weren't at your best, it's not going to hurt anything. You just come out the next day and try to be better.
Yeah. You mentioned that you've got another little musher on the way. Does the rest of the family run at all?
My wife, Bree, was a really good, she could be a great musher, but she really, it's not in her heart. And she ran one race once and did great in it, and she pretty much said that's enough. She started out really handling a lot for me and running the dogs with me. And, she likes going out with small teams and stuff like that, but, that's the most she wants to do. I'm not sure if I can remember the question too well, but she's big-time support, but
that's
not
awesome.
In the dog yard.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. It's got to be huge, especially when you're doing the mid and long distance. I can't imagine not having that support mechanism.
Yeah.
And if I could go back just a second so let's say I'm going to run with a 5-dog team. So we're going to go out for the average musher question here. And I need 5 dogs to race. Should I just have 5 dogs? Or if you just were in a 5-dog race, how many dogs would you have if you were going to run, say, 5 races this winter with this 5-dog team?
Well, me, I would want to have at least 7.
Okay.
Just in case somebody's got a hurt wrist or, or just whatever. Just things happen. Like if I'm going to a 12-dog race and I've got to drive, 500 miles to get there, I always bring 13 dogs. So that one of them ends up riding in the truck the whole time. Just a little bit of security. And you got to make sure you got, some leadership there. And it's tough
right.
When you've got a really small kennel because, if you just got one leader, you're really putting all your eggs in one basket. So I would make I would train just a little bit more than I raced. And, it can be frustrating because you got to leave somebody at home if you go to a race. But, you could do it with 5 dogs, too. It all depends what your goals are. I mean, if you want to compete and, get as high up in the standings as you can, you're going to want a slightly bigger program. But if you're not concerned with that, then don't worry about it.
No, that's awesome.
Well, and the reason we ask is because, we have got 5 people racing, so we need 16 dogs. And when we tell people around here, obviously we're in northern Michigan, so it's a little odd to have 20 dogs. It's not Alaska. But at the same point, we're kind of short because I've got 5 people running on various size teams, and I only have 4 extra dogs.
As you look at the whole sport, where do you see the sport going in the future from your perspective? Obviously, you're not only running in it, which is awesome, but you're also writing about it. You've seen a lot of changes since the 90s. What are you seeing most of the changes, and which direction do you think the sport's going?
That just reminded me of, I got my first back-in-the-day comment last year. Somebody talked about back-in-the-day when I raced the Iditarod, and I last raced it in 2003. It hasn't changed a whole lot as far as what you need to do well, but obviously some of the technology, Jeff King and some of the sled design has changed since 2003, and it appears that people are still tinkering with that. There's definitely more that can be done. I think we're only a fraction of the way into understanding how to harness a sled dog and get them to perform at their best. Mitch Seavey has his system, and both what Jeff came up with and what Mitch came up with, and versus the traditional Taiga style, the X-Back, they're interesting departures, and it's a lot of fun watching that develop.
Yeah, it hasn't really gotten too crazy as far as, electronics and that type of thing, but...
No, but it's creeping in. I think the Iditarod is playing with the idea of GPS units in the sled so that people can track their favorite musher. I don't know if that'll ever happen. It's just been talked about. Electronics, you need batteries, and you're in some pretty cold country for a long time. You're off the road system. It might get in a little bit, but I don't think... it's not going to be like NASCAR where you got spotters and people with laptops telling you what you need to do next. And which is good. That would violate the spirit of the Iditarod anyway. There's other races where you can have all the help you want. I think it's an Alaskan thing, and it may not be in the lower 48, but in Alaska, for some reason, the ethic is you're on your own. You get to a race, it's you and the dogs, and you get no outside assistance. It's sort of this code of honor.
Might give you a knife or a gun, but nothing else, right?
Yeah. Well, competitors can help each other. but you don't have a pit crew. Where is it going?
Do you see it expanding, or do you see it more limiting? You know, I mean, we're hoping that it's growing, but I guess from your perspective, what do you think it is?
I think it's actually growing. It's my sense, just from the media interest in it and the way it sort of shows up in the national everyday media, the mention Iditarod in passing, obviously people are paying attention to it. The coverage it's getting through the Cabela's website, and also Iditarod's video is breathtaking. You know, it's really, really good quality video, and I think people are visually, you know, they watch a lot more than they read, I think, sometimes, and so that's a strength as far as getting exposure. You know, it's going to have some growing pains yet, but I think it's growing. I mean, there's more races and more mushers in the lower 48.
Now, with your writing, has your writing obviously changed with the internet taking off and so forth, Cabela's launching the web pages, and you being able to write? That's probably helped from your perspective getting the word out. But have you had to change your writing styles for the internet and so forth?
Well, I have to write faster, that's for sure. When I was working at a newspaper, I had a little bit more time. I try to write in kind of a newspaper style, and maybe even to a fault. I kind of mix in a little bit. I do. It's more of a blog style now. I'll use the personal. I'll talk about I saw this or I did this, and this reminds me of what I used to do. Because if I think that'll be helpful or somehow illustrate things, and you just don't do that in a newspaper article. So, yeah, it's a more personal style, which I really enjoy, and perhaps don't even do enough of. We'll see if that changes.
You know, looking at the I don't want to say the attention span of the consumer today and so forth, you know, they want the smaller bites sometimes in writing, but I love your articles because they are a little more robust than maybe the little soundbite you'll catch on a news feed from CNN or, you know, Drudge Report or something like that on the race. And so when you, I guess in the stories themselves, are you looking for the human side of it, the animal side, or the adventure side? Do you look for all of them? What are some good writing things that you look for?
Definitely all of the above. I want desperately to write more about the dogs, but it doesn't come up as easily as you'd think it would, and I don't know why that is, but I'll tend to write more about the mushers. What's going on with them, what they're thinking, what they're experiencing, trying to paint a picture of the event so that somebody reading it can really get closer to the action because it's so far away. And in the writing, one advantage to the writing is you can get more detail. You learn more when you read than you will with certainly with sound bites and with video on some levels. You can see more, obviously, with video, but I think you can get a deeper story, I think, in the writing. And they're a good I think there's room for all of the above. I mean, every sort of media has its advantages and disadvantages.
Do you have a favorite story at all?
I wrote one. I was just talking to Ed Eaton once it was 2 years ago, I think, or maybe 3 years ago at Ruby. And he just started telling me about this dog of his, and the name escapes me right now, and what a super little dog she was. And I wasn't even taking notes. I went back and typed it in the computer. And that was one I did write about, a dog, and she was just a super lead dog, just amazing. And he was just so impressed with her and in love with her and happy with what she does. That one was a good one. There's been some good moments I've captured on the trail, usually at Cripple or Iditarod checkpoints when things are really starting to happen. The mushers will just sort of open up and we'll have some nice moments.
Any scary moments covering the race, I guess? Have you been any spots where you say, gosh, you know, this was really crazy to come out in this or do anything nuts?
Every year. For some reason, getting over Rainy Pass is almost impossible every year, and it actually kind of causes me to not be where I want to be at certain parts of the race because we're in a Cessna 185, which is, doesn't seem to weigh much more than a kite. And the winds will be howling through Rainy Pass, and you've got to hold on to, there's a bar and, a strut, that you hold on to just to stop from hitting your head on the roof of the plane. And I just think the wings are going to fall off at certain times.
I want to hear that story. I want you to write about that one, the white knuckle over Rainy Pass.
Yeah, it's the same every year. It's just unbelievable. It's just, there's always howling winds coming right through the mountain passes, and the little plane has to fight its way through there.
Oh, that's wild. Now, so you take obviously you're taking a plane from spot to spot throughout the race?
That's right. Yeah, it's amazing how quick it is by airplane.
Yeah, can imagine the difference, huh?
Yeah.
So do you generally take notes? Do you record? How, you know, Or are you taking your laptop and writing it as you're getting it? I mean, how does that work for you?
I'm somewhat old school. I have a pen and some notebooks, and so I try to jot down notes as I'm talking to people. And actually, I try to put that – I've learned that putting the notepad away helps, because if you're stuck there trying to write, you don't necessarily – your conversation's going to be a little stilted. If I had a handheld recorder, I'd probably use it, but then you've got to go back and play it, and that slows you down a little bit. So what I really try to do is listen, get the gist of what's going on, and then run back to my laptop and write it as best as I can as I see it, throwing in whatever quotes I could write down, and get it out and on the web page as quickly as I can. I do about 3 a day, which probably doesn't sound like much, but when you're talking to people, when you're going from place to place and sitting down and writing, it fills up the day big time. You don't have much room.
That's huge, John. That is absolutely unbelievable that you can crank out 3 a day. I mean, it's just
and sometimes
amazing.
It's more if there's a dispatch. Like a lot of times, like at Nikolai, the first team's coming into there. They're really setting the pace, and usually they're going to be among those that win, and that happened again this year. So at Nikolai, I'll try to get in there and say, hey, Paul Gephardt just got in. You know, it'll be a short blurb just saying what's going on.
So do you have your predictions for this year?
For winners?
Well, for not only winners, but, you know, some good, you know, preliminary stories that we can start spreading.
Well, I really dropped the ball on Paul Gephardt last year. I didn't see him coming, and that was absolutely just not good observation skills on my part. I mean, he pretty much said, I got a great team, and everything indicated that he did. And so I think if that team holds together well, and he'll tell you if it does or if it's not or if it is.
How do you choose that up front? Because I know, you know, this time of the year you're starting to try to plan strategy on, because you can't write about everybody. So how do you kind of choose on who to write about or preliminary writing and so forth?
A lot of it's gut level. I'll just start talking to various people. Maybe I'll think, well, I haven't written about this person for a while, or this is a new face, and just try to see what's going on.
You know, I think that's probably why having you as a musher and not just a reporter jumping into the scene, that's why it's so awesome, is because you do have that gut feeling. I mean, it's all that experience kind of rolled up into the ability to see and foresee what's going to happen.
Yeah, and nobody can pick what's going to happen in the race. You know, you might get lucky, but it's just that's the beauty of the Iditarod and other races is, you know, the race takes care of all that. And all these great plans coming in, you could have dogs that suddenly get diarrhea, which happened to Robert Sorley this year, and
Well, look at Dee Dee and Swingley. We would have never guessed that.
Yeah. That was rough, and for them, extremely rough. And, yeah, and you just don't know. And both of those guys had really good teams.
Yeah.
And so that definitely affected the outcome of the race. I still think Lance Mackey had the team to beat. I don't want anyone to think that I would say otherwise, because obviously, you know, usually the best team wins, and his team peaked. They were beautiful.
I don't think anybody could just giggle and laugh with him when he crossed the finish line and at the end. I mean, the enthusiasm, the excitement, and the passion he had, I think the whole world that was watching and listening was just like, oh, you know, just our hearts were with him, you know. It was exciting.
But I'd say that whole top five, and actually a lot more than that, but just singling out, you know, you could talk about so many teams, but I would say, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, the whole top five had that passion, had that real connection that I talked about. They all have a relationship with their dogs. That's Lance, Paul, Martin Boozer. Actually, I got it backwards. Zach Steer, Martin Boozer, and Jeff King. They all have really good relationships with their dogs, and they all have a lot of charisma and a lot of passion. There's more. There's a whole bunch more that, you know, out of the top five, but I'm just picking those as examples, and there's a reason that they finished as high as they did.
Those last few hours, where are you? Are you at the finish line?
Yeah, I'm usually running on fumes. It's something that I haven't figured out how to deal with. I can usually be pretty strong up until White Mountain, at which time I have to figure out, you know, I have to pick my battles a little more. But usually by the time they get to the finish line, I write a couple stories about the first and second place team. I'll catch maybe 4 hours sleep, in which case I miss a couple teams coming in, and then I have to try to catch up with them and try to scramble.
That's got to be tough. Do you travel alone, or do you travel with a team of folks?
It's basically the pilot and me, but there's usually a few other people flying up, but a lot of them are simply going up to watch the race, you know, from the closest possible vantage point, but they're not media.
So the president or the CEO of Cabela's isn't sitting next to you the whole time?
No, Nope, haven't. Okay. Haven't had that happen. But there's people who pay for a seat in the airplane and have a great time.
Oh, that is fantastic.
Any other interesting things that you'd like to tell us about the writing? And you know, I think we have a lot of younger listeners, too, that think, wow, what a great profession it would be to write, and let alone write for an awesome sport like mushing. Is there anything that you'd like to speak to the journalists out there, the younger journalists? Don't do it. Do it.
Well, it's you better have a passion for it. If you want to get rich, it's not the way to go. And if you don't mind about that, fine. I'd say, this isn't a direct answer to your question, but when I'm writing, especially during the race, it's like everything I get out there is like a little writing drill. It's like a speed writing. In college, I took some art classes, and we had to like sketch really fast. You had a few seconds to draw a picture or something. And a lot of times, that's the writing that I do on the trail is I get it out as fast as I can, and that doesn't mean I'm writing something bad. It's basically I got to go with just the first impression, keep it as sharp as I can. And I think that kind of does get back to your question, is if you're writing about something, just try to get the point across. Don't try to be too artsy, and then you can always go back and change it, you know, later. There's so much. That would be a whole other hour-long interview if you want to get into how to write. And it's something I haven't, spent a lot of time thinking about. That sounds bad, but, in preparation for this conversation, I'm definitely somebody who writes based on what I think somebody can understand, and I think that's important. It's like, does it make sense? Read it out loud. If you can't read it out loud, probably somebody who's reading it isn't going to get it either. And I run it by my wife. Everybody needs editing, and she's the closest person here, and if I've written something, I say, if I'm writing from home, I'll just say, can you read this over? And she's one of my best editors. She'll say, I don't get this. What is this? That sentence doesn't make sense. And don't be offended by that.
Well, is there anything else, John, that you'd like to talk to the audience about or tell us about?
Oh, I guess there'd probably be a lot, but nothing comes to mind right now other than two things that people told me when I was starting out. One was you take care of them and they'll take care of you, about the dogs. It better be fun, because if it's not, you better get out. Is the other piece of advice that I was given when I started out, and I think they're both very important.
Well, and I'm jotting those two things down.
We should write it on the side of our sled shed.
I think so, for sure. Well, thank you so much, John. This has been great.
Oh yeah, it's been fun.
I hope you enjoyed that. We really did. John helped us with so much information, so much knowledge about how to manage a good kennel, and also to see a different perspective on the love of the sport. And someone that's dedicated their life to not just, just mush and to play in the sport and also to race the races, but also is dedicated to sharing that sport with others. And I have a large passion for that, because it reminds us of what we're trying to do. But more importantly is, we don't have to hang on to a plane in order to bring this podcast to you. Not yet, anyways. So it was a fantastic opportunity for us. I hope you enjoyed it. And again, go to www.sleddogpodcast.com.
Now, wait a second there, Tim. We've got one more little short interview coming right after this, don't we?
We do. I forgot all about that.
Each episode, we're going to try to tag on to the end what we are now calling the Vet Tips from Dr. Tim.
So here it goes. It's going to be Vet Tips with Dr. Tim Hunt from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. He's got Dr. Tim's Pet Foods. Fantastic gentleman, wonderful speaker, has been very helpful to us, and not only with his food products, but also his knowledge. And he's going to talk to us every week that we have a podcast about different topics. So this week's going to be the topic on
foot care.
Foot care. And so here we go.
Fantastic. So, Dr. Tim, why don't you tell us a little bit about feet care and what we should look for with our dog's feet?
Sure. I think the most important thing with feet that you need to do is to look at your feet, dog's feet, all the time. And to me, the best way to look at dog's feet is with a headlamp. I can see much better in the feet that way than I can during the day. You have to know normal to know abnormal. So if you're always checking their feet after a run to kind of see what each dog's foot is looking like, you got to look at feet. You can't just imagine that it's okay. Once you start to know the normal of each dog's foot, then you can start to pick up the early signs of splits and fissures much sooner than if you wait until they're huge and big and unsightly painful messes. So if you're always paying attention to your dog's feet starting in the fall, we go into winter, which is more the common time that you're going to see fissures in feet, even though you can see them sometimes with wet weather. What you'll start to look for, looking for splits, and splits are the small little crevices, kind of like athlete's foot, that you'll get yourself on underneath your toes. Dogs get it in between their foot pads on the bottom of their feet. They tend to be linear lines that appear maybe a half to an inch long. Often will start as white lines, and then they progress into splits, which will be like crevices or valleys, and then they can deepen actually considerably and get infected. So if you know what the normal foot anatomy looks like, when you flip that foot upside down, you're looking in between the toe pads, or the foot pads, I should say, and looking at the webbing, then you'll know when those white lines start to appear. When you hit those kind of white lines appearing, that's the time you can actually cut them off at the pass if we miss the preventative type thing. So I'll go on treatment first, which is you see the white lines on those feet appearing. Those are early splits or fissures. Elzevil works pretty good. That's an ointment out there that you can use topically. You can also use Desitin, which is a zinc oxide-based ointment, where you put it on there, and often you can arrest them at that point and slow it down. What you don't want to use when you start to see splits in the feet would be anything containing a steroid, which is going to impede the healing and then make those splits all the worse. If you look underneath that foot and you see something bigger than just a white line actually starting up, you can still use those products, but often you're going to have to go to something with a zinc oxide and an antibiotic mixed into it to help to get those to heal up. And it's not life-threatening, these splits, but they can be painful. You know, you walk around with cuts on your feet, it doesn't exactly feel good if you're walking on a beach, which is similar to snow. So with the dogs, when you start to see these kind of things, you might want to use that ointment and then use booties on their feet when you run them. But then it progresses from there. You know, if you see bigger splits than, let's say, half an inch and they're somewhat deep, you're going to put them on oral antibiotics at that point, too. The ones we like to use tend to be either clindamycin, Dytrim, or something called cephalexin. Those are good antibiotics you can get from your veterinarian or online, for that matter. And then just go with the normal protocol as to how much to use and for how long. But again, you want to pay attention to those feet in training. So let me go back to foot care as preventative. I talked briefly there about looking at the feet in the fall, knowing what's normal to know abnormal. If you're looking at more of a preventative scheme with foot care, and primarily foot care means what's on the bottom of the feet, the diet you feed them can play an important part. Zinc has an important role in trying to help eliminate foot issues. It's not always the panacea. It's not going to be the thing that takes care of all the foot issues, but it can help dramatically in some cases. The line of dogs can also make a huge difference. The genetics of good feet versus bad feet definitely carry through with dogs. You can see different houndy dogs that have terrible feet, and then some of these dogs that come from Fairbanks and where they really selected for good feet, having terrific feet no matter what the conditions are. So the line of dog can play a huge difference too. And then thirdly, after nutrition, genetics would be any sort of an ointment that we would use preemptively on the feet. I think sometimes it does help. A lot of people like to use like Sula zinc ointment, again a zinc oxide type ointment as a preventative. You don't need a lot, you just put a little bit in there. But again, you want to experiment with this stuff in training to get the dogs used to it, nothing new in a race. So you can put a small amount in between the toe pads there of the dogs to act as a preventative. My recommendation to people before you start really doing that is run your dogs for a while in the snow and see what dogs actually have good and bad feet, and then you can streamline your work. You don't need to treat every dog or with preventative ointment. You might find a lot of dogs in your team don't need it. So give it a little trial run in the snow and see what the feet look like after some runs and then judge it from there. But it tends to carry through with certain lines. I'll definitely see in my yard where if I have a female that has puppies that has had notoriously poor feet, the puppies are going to have somewhat poor feet too. So it will definitely carry through. So that would be the preventative end of it. Then I talked about the treatment there with the different devices of trying to help that out. Thirdly, with the feet would tend to be, you know, the obvious nail care. We just keep them trimmed. But then we get into booties. People always wonder, when do I use booties, when do I not? I think people tend to overuse booties in that when you put a sock on your foot and run around in it, it can make you a little bit more susceptible to injuring a shoulder or a wrist than if you didn't have the bootie on. I think the bootie is helpful with certain conditions, like certain snow types. I would really look at what the cross-country ski sites talk about, the snow types, and that can teach you a lot with what we're looking for with their feet. So when you go into one of these cross-country online websites and they talk about the old crystals versus the new crystals and how abrasive they are, that can just give you a real good feeling of what to expect if you're out on a 20-degree day with fresh snow versus a 20-below day with old snow, as to how abrasive it is. The other thing I'll tend to say, if that's getting just too scientific for folks, is when you're on the runners themselves and you're not sure about the snow, stick, take your hand out of your glove, put it on the snow as you're getting tugged along and see what your hand feels like. If it's abrasive, well, there you go. If it's not, probably we're going to be okay. That's just a general guideline, but you got to know your dogs because they all react a little differently to the snow. But old snow versus new snow, you know, how humid it is can all play a factor in how abrasive it is on their feet. What else?
I had a question, Dr. Tim. Yeah. Now, you're talking about preventative care and also if something is wrong with the feet. Now, would the dog be telling me, like, by limping or something else going on with him, or maybe not? Could there be something wrong with the feet without limping?
The best way to look at a dog with poor feet is suddenly the dog isn't pulling as hard in some instances. They just seem to be a little bit behind the other ones. They're still, their gait might look normal, but they're just not as energetic as the rest. That's one general thing I'll see with poor feet, is they just slow down. So they don't always really have an obvious limp with these splits. They just will slow down, and they might not be able to keep up with the main team. So I think you need to look at those feet, you know, every time you unhook to see what you got going on, or even during the run for that matter, just to learn about the dog's feet. But they will not always give you a limp with a split on the foot. Some will. You know, those are the dogs that aren't real tough that way with pain thresholds, and that's okay. You just learn how to work with that dog. But no, they don't always give you an obvious sign. What my experience is that they just slow down.
Great.
Dr. Tim, if people are running on, like, gravel roads versus just dirt trails for the fall, is there a negative to running on the gravel roads with the stones and that type of thing at all?
Yeah, definitely gravel. It's really hard to go very far on gravel because it's going to actually wear their nails down more than anything. And what I'll see with gravel feet is they'll wear their nails down into the quick, and then their feet will bleed. Their nails are actually bleeding. That hurts more than anything else. So I've seen people, and I've done it myself, where I've had to run on gravel or hard asphalt, for that matter, where we accidentally run their nails down too short, and those dogs are sore, and they often will have to be laid off for quite a while. So gravel, the adage that, like Boozer used to say, you wouldn't go more than 10 miles on a gravel road, I think that's pushing it in my book. I don't like to go very far at all on gravel, maybe 6 or 8 miles, maybe 10 if I have to, but I try to find sand if I can do it. But mainly it's the nails that you run into with gravel roads more than their foot pads, in my experience.
Well, thank you. That was great.
Sure.
Thank you, Dr. Tim, and thank you all for listening. We are so appreciative of all the feedback that we're getting from everybody. Keep those comments and emails coming. Again, you can email us at sleddog@vbs20.com or go to the website www.sleddogpodcast.com. Let us know what you think. Give us some comments. And also, if you want to be interviewed or if you know somebody that wants to be interviewed, let us know and we'll get them on the show. Have a great day.
Be blessed, everyone.